Good morning, everybody. So I'm going to continue on the theme, and in particular, I'm going to tell you about advances in genetics and how these advances in genetics are actually helping us go towards personalized medicine. I'm going to also discuss with you what's new and what may become new in bone marrow transplant, and also about gene therapy, the present status, and what the perspectives will be. So let me start by telling you a little bit about genetics. And we are in a very interesting time when we are actually discovering the molecular basis of a variety of the diseases. And this is really happening because there has been a dramatic change in technology. Sometimes great ideas make major breakthroughs. Sometimes it's technology that actually allows us to identify new genes and by that mechanism understand what is the basis of the disease. And the way this is done is basically to take a person's DNA, break it into fragments, link something at the extremities of these fragments, and then use it as a bait to go and sequence across the fragment of the DNA, searching for abnormalities in that specific fragment of the DNA, and then see what is what does that fragment belong to, what gene does it belong to, and what's wrong with that gene. And so this is actually what we call all exome or all genome sequencing, and many of you have probably agreed to participate in this kind of studies with the hope that actually that will help us and you understand better the disease. Now, this technology undoubtedly have very high analytical power, and as I mentioned, in fact, have allowed us to identify quite a number of new genes in the past few years. Very importantly, until, I want to say, about 7 to 10 years ago, you really were in need of having multiple family members affected, and even more so, many families with the same disease, in order to identify for sure that a specific variant in the DNA was responsible for that specific disease. The power of this technology is that it allows identify the basis, the genetic basis of the disease, even in a single patient. And that's absolutely extraordinary. Also, equally important, I would say, the costs of the technology are becoming progressively lower and lower. And of course, this facilitates applicability of this technique to a broader number of patients. But there are also some issues with interpretation of the results. The idea that any specific genetic condition may result from a single change in the structure of the DNA is not always right. In some cases, we're missing a portion of a gene or an entire gene. This is called copy number variation. And just by looking at the sequence of the DNA, you may miss those cases. So there is a need, in fact, to complement all exome sequencing or all genome sequencing with alternative techniques that actually look for this variation in the copy number in your gene, in the genome. The whole exome sequencing only looks at exomes, which are actually the regions of the genes that eventually encode for a product, most often a protein. But there are a number of diseases where the defect is not really in the exomes, it's really in regulatory regions, and so those would be missed by all exome sequencing. And it's important to remember that if you fail to identify a specific reason, a molecular basis for the disease, it may be because you haven't used the right technology. But even more complicated is the point that not all of the, when you do all exome sequencing, you find quite often quite a number, all of us actually have quite a number of genetic variants. And so you end up having hundreds of genetic variants. How do you know which one is the one that is responsible for the disease? And this is where really things often are complicated. A new concept is that it has been realized that many individuals actually carry more than one genetic variant which may contribute to the disease phenotype. And so when you have multiple variants at the same time, the clinical presentation of the disease may actually be more subtle, may be more complicated, realizing what we call blended phenotypes, where you have multiple diseases at the same time or multiple contributory factors to the disease itself. And so dissecting all of these is not trivial, but clearly a lot of progress has been made. And to illustrate this progress, I'm showing this slide. Now, this is showing the actual number of immunodeficiency genes that have been discovered and clearly associated with a specific form of primary immunodeficiency over the years. Now, I remember at the beginning of the year 2000, when one of the severe combined immunodeficiency genes was identified, there was an editorial which was entitled, "Have we seen the last primary immunodeficiency gene? How wrong?" In fact, you see there's a continuous evolution, a continuous increase in the number of genes that are being discovered, which actually indicates that we are not even close to finishing this race. There are many more genes that have yet to be discovered. And so there is, of course, a lot of attention to this problem. There is a need to collaborate among different people working in the field to share information, work with you, patients, to better understand what is the correlation between a specific abnormality in the genome and what is the clinical presentation. How can that actually be applied to improve care? And this is what I want to discuss next, which is how, in fact, we can translate this improvement in understanding the basis of the disease, how can we translate that into a different form of treatment, into what we now call personalized medicine. I'm going to give you one example from a very, very recent literature for one specific disease that was discovered actually at the NIH. So the disease I'm going to talk about is called CTLA-4 deficiency. I use it as an example of how discovering molecular basis of the disease can actually translate into new forms of treatment. So when we mount an immune response, and let's say you have a T lymphocyte that recognizes a specific antigen, perhaps you're fighting a viral infection, perhaps you're encountering some kind of a pathogen you need to recognize and fight, the T cell uses the T cell receptor to specifically recognize that antigen, but that signal alone is not sufficient to drive activation of the immune system. You also need another signal, represented in this cartoon by the CD28 molecule that binds to this other molecule, CD80 or CD86, expressed by the antigen-presenting cell. And those two signals instruct T cells to be activated, and the T cells proliferate, and so you mount an immune response. However, at some point, you also need to extinguish the immune response, because otherwise your immune system becomes continuously activated, and that may be as bad, and in some cases even actually worse, than not being able to mount an effective response. So how do we extinguish that kind of an immune response? Well, the T cell, at that point, expresses another molecule, which is called, in fact, CTLA-4, which also binds to CD80 and CD86 at much higher affinity. And so the T cells that now express CTLA-4 have an advantage over the T cells that are still expressing CD28. And that is enough to extinguish the immune response. So you stop having proliferation of the T cells. So this is how you mount an immune response and you extinguish an immune response once you no longer need it. Now, the people at the NIH have actually discovered this disease where individuals have only one copy of the CTLA-4 gene and they're missing the other good copy. So they only have half of the protein, and having half of the protein is not enough to properly extinguish the immune responses. What is the clinical presentation? These patients have progressive lung disease, they develop lung damage, they have accumulation of lymphocytes as a result of this ongoing continuous immune activation in the lungs, in the brain, in mucosal tissues. They develop autoimmunity, so they have anemia, thrombocytopenia. They also have problems with their immunoglobulins, hypogammaglobulinemia. And they eventually develop also loss of T cells, but the T cells that are there are still activated T cells. There's another disease that was known also since a few years, which shares many similarities with CTLA-4 deficiency, and it's called LRBA deficiency. Some patients with common variable immune deficiency were eventually found to have LRBA deficiency, which is in fact a combined immunodeficiency. These patients are also suffering from chronic lung disease. They have lymphoid infiltrates in the lungs, in the gut. In fact, they have prominent diarrhea with lots of lymphocytes in the gut. And sometimes people are diagnosed with another very severe immunodeficiency called IPEX. Sometimes they're given a diagnosis of inflammatory bowel disease before actually being recognized with this specific diagnosis of LRBA deficiency. Also, these patients have autoimmunity in the blood, so they have anemia, thrombocytopenia. They also have hypogammaglobulinemia. I already mentioned that quite often they're confused with CVID. They have a variable number of T cells, but again, these T cells are activated. And so now you see that you have a very similar phenotype. How can that be? Well, because in fact, LRBA is important in order to maintain CTLA-4 expression on the membrane. So if you have LRBA deficiency, you don't have enough CTLA-4 on the cell surface. So you end up having a very similar mechanism of the disease, where the defect of CTLA-4 is responsible for the ongoing and continuous immune activation. How can we translate this new information into new treatment? Well, I mentioned that, of course, if you are deficient in CTLA-4, either because you have a genetic defect in CTLA-4 or because you have an LRBA deficiency, what happens is that you have ongoing activation of the immune system because your T cells cannot extinguish the continuous activation. And so you have uncontrolled proliferation of T cells, you also have B cell abnormalities. So how to get around that? Well, people have invented a drug, which is called abatacept or CTLA-4-IG, where you now produce a soluble form of CTLA-4 linked to a fragment of the immunoglobulin, and you administer that drug to the patient. And by doing this, you're blocking CD80 and CD86. And as a result of that, now you block the T-cell activation. This drug is effective in LRBA deficiency. Perhaps it's maybe surprisingly not so effective in CTLA-4 deficiency alone, but you can use alternative drugs that also suppress the immune system and spare the regulatory T-cell function, the function of regular T-cells, which are important in controlling immune activation, sirolimus, or rapamycin. And so by using this information of what is the base of the disease, now you come up with specific treatment for the condition of these patients. You, in fact, realize what we call now personalized medicine. So rather than using broadly immunosuppressive drugs, rather than just by giving immunoglobulins, which are, of course, important in these patients, you use the drugs that block the nature of the disease at its own roots. And so we hope that this is also be true for many other disorders that are being discovered by understanding the base of the disease. We hope we can come up with more effective, more specific, more personalized forms of treatment. Now, let me tell you a little bit of what's going on in terms of hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, how the results have improved, what are we learning from new ways of performing transplant, can we apply this strategy to other diseases that haven't been treated so far with bone marrow transplantation. Well, I should say that for rare diseases like primary immunodeficiencies, having a network of centers collecting and analyzing data, having active enrollment of patients, and so maintaining a dialogue between physicians on the one hand and the patient population on the other hand is absolutely essential. And so what I'm going to show you in the next slide is actually the result of the activity of the Primary Immunodeficiency Treatment Consortium, or PITC, and many of you may have agreed, in fact, to participate at this study where physicians were treating patients by bone marrow transplant or other forms of treatment like gene therapy or enzyme replacement therapy are collecting data on the clinical natural history of these patients, how they are doing following transplantation or these other treatments, what can we learn from what we have done so far, how can we do better in the future. The centers are present throughout the country, also in Canada, and so this is a North American study, and we are partnering also with centers in Europe for joint projects across the ocean. And by increasing the number of patients that are being studied, hopefully we'll be able to do even better in the future. But let me give you one example why these kind of studies are very important. Dr. Buckley has actually been the first one to advocate that transplantation for babies with severe combined immunodeficiency should be performed early in life, less than 3.5 months of life, in order to guarantee much better perspectives of survival and overall cure, up to 90-95%. These were results of a single center. And so it was important to confirm these in a larger series of patients and perhaps to go even farther and try to understand why is this happening? Why is it so important to treat patients with SCID so early in life? So the results of the PRETC study shown in this slide shows that in fact Dr. Buckley was absolutely right. If you transplant babies with SCID at less than 3.5 months of age, the blue curve, the overall survival is actually close to 95%. Amazing result for an otherwise, as you know, fatal disease. But if you transplant babies that are older than 3.5 months of life, well, then it really depends what is the clinical status of the patient. In fact, if you have patients older than 3.5 months of life, but with no infection before transplantation, this is the green curve, the results are almost equivalent to patients who go to transplant at less than 3.5 months of life. On the contrary, the red curve, if you have patients older than 3.5 months of life who do have an infection at the time of transplantation, survival, unfortunately, is worse, close to 50%. So what really matters is, in fact, having or not having an infection at the time of transplantation. And of course, the younger the baby is, the less likely it is that that patient will go to transplant with an infection. And this is why it is important to recognize these patients early in life. Not only that, but Dr. Buckley has also advocated use of transplantation from a father or a mother without conditioning for patients with SCID. And again, she was right in that if you have an infection, and so you are in the worst case scenario that I showed in the previous slide, and now you go to transplant from a father or a mother, you better be without chemotherapy. Because without chemotherapy, you still have approximately 70% survival rate, but if you use chemotherapy, survival is close to 40%. So all of this is crucial information that has dramatically changed our approach to transplant for babies with SCID. It has also told us that, in fact, Dr. Pak was absolutely right in advocating newborn screening for severe combined immunodeficiency. Because with newborn screening, you can actually identify these babies in a pre-symptomatic phase of their disease, when they haven't developed yet infections. And so you may facilitate definitive treatment, most often transplantation, without having any infection at the time of transplantation, and thereby providing the better chances of definitive cure, 90-95%. This has dramatically changed our view of severe combined immunodeficiencies, our perspectives in treating this disease or this group of diseases. And so that's one example how much progress has been made in the field. But what about other forms of immunodeficiencies where, in fact, chemotherapy is required in order to obtain engraftment and resolution of the disease? Chronic granulomatous disease is one of the diseases where results of transplant for many years have been controversial. And many groups have actually struggled finding good outcome for these patients, to the point that, in fact, there was a debate whether transplant was a reasonable option or should it actually be reserved for patients who are extremely sick, where medical management alone would not suffice to take good care of the patients and allow good perspectives of survival. Well, again, things have changed. Through collaborative studies, in this case in Europe, the group of Zurich has shown that if you target your chemotherapy to a lower level, but not too low, they call this reduced intensity conditioning. It's not a very aggressive form of treatment, but it's not a mild form either. Now you have excellent survival regardless of the donor type. So not only if you have a matched sibling, but also if you're using an unrelated donor. Not only you have excellent survival, close to 90%, But you also have excellent event-free survival, which means you cure the disease and eliminate all of the manifestations of the disease in approximately 80% of the patients. This is totally different than our previous experience with CJD. Because of this result, other groups have used similar approaches in other forms of primary immunodeficiencies, and in particular the group of Rebecca Marsh at Cincinnati has used a very similar approach to treat hemophagocytic lymphohistiocytosis, which is also a very difficult disease to treat. These patients are prone to viral infections. They have uncontrolled activation of the immune system that results eventually in organ damage, multiple organ failure, and unfortunately quite often death unless the patient can be rescued. But the results of transplantation in these patients for a long period of time has been very unsuccessful, with patients often dying of treatment-related complications and at other times dying of their own disease. By using, again, reduced intensity conditioning, the group of Cincinnati has shown that this disease can actually be effectively cured in the vast majority of the cases. The same approach can be used for other disorders. You may have heard about X-linked lymphoproliferative disease, which shares many similarities with HLH. And again, the results are excellent, with 70-80% not only long-term survival, but in fact also cure of the manifestations of the disease. So the way we do transplant, the ways we do transplant now are, you don't have to think of transplant as one single type of intervention. We can modulate the way we do transplant by using no chemotherapy, a lot of chemotherapy, something in between. And we really have to target this to the specific condition of the patient and the clinical status of that patient from time to time. Okay, now what about new indications? Is it possible, now that transplant has become a more effective form of treatment, is it possible to think of transplantation also for other forms of immunodeficiencies that really haven't been treated with transplantation so far? And so the group in Freiburg was interested in considering transplantation for common variable immune deficiency. We would not consider transplantation as a primary form of treatment for this disease. There are, in fact, other forms of treatment that should come first. Of course, intravenous immunoglobulin is number one, and a better control of all of the immune dysregulation manifestation of the disease is number two. But there are cases where the patient's clinical status is, in fact, compromised, and so people have considered, well, can we do better? Can we offer transplant to these patients who have very advanced disease? And so it was interesting to see what the results of this study were. Because again, it was a multi-center experience which was pioneered by the group in Freiburg, and they treated 25 patients between 8 and 50 years. The results of this study had just been published, and these were obviously patients who had very complicated course of CVID. The majority of them had manifestations of autoimmunity of various kinds. A number were considered for transplant because they had developed lymphoma, which, as you know, is a complication of CVID. Others had severe infection, and there were patients also with frank leukemia, acute myeloid leukemia. So these are all, you know, serious complications where when you fail conventional therapy, you consider alternative form of treatment, and transplant could be one of those. They received different type of transplants. Again, some had a matched family donor, 14 of them did. 6 were unrelated donor, but there were also 5 patients who received a mismatched unrelated donor transplantation. Different types of conditioning or chemotherapy. In some cases, reduced intensity. In others, myeloablative. Again, a heterogeneous cohort, so you learn from whatever data you have, but the data are interesting and tell us what can be fixed, where we need to improve. Overall survival was not excellent, 48%, but remember these were patients with very advanced course of the disease. And so having 48% survival, and as I will show in a minute, resolution of the existing complication is already some progress, and is telling us that perhaps in some cases we should consider this option. Having a lymphoma, which was expected actually to be a negative factor in terms of perspective of survival, was not. Actually, the patient with lymphoma did better than the patients who had autoimmune complications. That actually is the group that did worse in this study. And they also identified a number of factors that negatively affected the outcome of transplantation. So we now know that if you have liver involvement, granulomatous disease, renal disease, lung disease, a positive family history, these are all factors that would put you at higher risk of not having a successful transplant. But if you're not in that situation, then your chances are actually better. They also noticed that transplants that were done in more recent years were more successful. And this is important because it's telling us that things are improving and perhaps we're offering new perspectives also for CVID in these patients. Graft-versus-host disease remains a problem, so we need to work in order to prevent reaction of the transplant against the host. And also, some patients didn't engraft very well. And so, again, there is a need to improve also there. But what about the immunological status of the patients following transplantation? Well, it's interesting that half of the patients that survived actually are now off intravenous immunoglobulins. They have normal immunoglobulin levels. Three patients have been tested and they make normal antibody production, so they're not even on antibiotics anymore. They have an improvement in the lymphocyte counts. So this is telling us that at least in a group of patients, by fixing whatever problem is in the blood cells, we're fixing completely all of the issues of the disease. It's telling us something about the biology of CVID. And very importantly, remember this was a group of very sick patients. It's also important to know that all of the complications that were associated with CVID and were the reasons why these patients were actually considered for transplant resolved. So we are going towards, you know, the right direction. Clearly there is much to be done. So where do we go from here? We need to better understand what CVID is. Perhaps we need to better define which patients and when might be eligible to transplantation. Not all of the patients with CVID should ever be considered for transplantation. We need to understand why only some of the patients resolve their immune issues and others remain dependent on IVIG and don't have good B-cell function. We need to identify how can we predict which patients are going to have a more severe course of the disease and so anticipate the intervention before they develop such bad complications. We need perhaps to work on the chemotherapy again and use a more gentle chemotherapy to eliminate some of the risks of toxicities that exist with transplantation. And at the same time, we need to do better in terms of prevention of the graft-versus-host disease. But we're learning, and we're learning, unfortunately we're learning the hard way because we're starting from the sick patients where the perspective of survival and cure are worse. But we are learning where we need to do better. Let me finish by telling you a little bit about gene therapy. And so again, gene therapy was a great hope, you know, years ago, and then there were problems, and now it's back, and it's becoming again a great hope for many patients. So the way we do gene therapy in current days is that you have the patient, you take the stem cell from the bone marrow or from peripheral blood of the patients, and then you treat these cells with a virus to introduce into the genome of the cell the right copy of the gene that the patient is missing. Then the cells are reinfused back into the patient. And typically you do this by giving chemotherapy if you need to or without chemotherapy. So the advantages of gene therapy is that the patient is its own donor, his or her own donor. So you're not using another donor. And so that eliminates the risk of graft-versus-host disease. So you have no graft-versus-host disease. Also, because you're inserting the gene into the genome, all of the cells that derive from that corrected stem cell will now contain a correct copy of the gene. And so you will continue to fix the disease in all of the progeny. The disease that actually served as the prototype to understand all the good and all the bad of gene therapy has been X-linked severe combined immunodeficiency disease, where patients, because of their problem in this gene called IL-2RG, or common gamma chain, lack T cells, lack NK cells, and have dysfunctional B lymphocytes. And so, initially, the groups in London and Paris have treated 20 patients with X-linked SCID by using gene therapy with this vector. Again, it's a virus. You have in blue the box containing the normal copy of the gene, IL-2RG, And in red, it's the engine of the virus. These are strong enhancers that allow the black the blue box to be expressed so that you make a normal copy of the common gamma chain protein. They did not use chemotherapy. They did not, in fact, use no other treatment other than reinfusion of the gene-corrected cells, and they did this in 20 patients. And 18 of these patients reconstituted the T cells very nicely and very promptly after treatment. As shown here, you have an increase in the T cell count, full normalization by 6 months post-gene therapy. 17 of the 20 are alive, and they maintain a very good T cell number, diverse repertoire of T cells, perfectly normal T cell function. The real problem, so to the point that actually people started thinking, well, maybe we have a cure now. We have a new way of doing a cure for this, you know, serious disease. Gene therapy is the way to go. Well, the problem is that we cannot control where the virus is going. And so using this strategy, it happened that in a series of patients, the virus integrated next to an oncogene. And the same engine that drove expression of the common gamma chain gene also induced expression of the oncogene. So in fact, 5 of these 20 patients developed leukemia. And that actually was, you know, it was unexpected, I have to say, and it was a great shock for the scientific community as well as for the patient's community, and put everything on hold for quite a number of years. So people had to go back and think how to modify the vector. And so the way they did this was to remove the red boxes, to get rid of this engine, which was potent but also harmful, and use now a weaker engine, which is shown now in pale blue here, EFS. This is a cellular promoter, so it's something we have our own in our own cells to drive expression of the common gamma chain gene. Again, the group in London, in Paris, Boston, Cincinnati, Los Angeles have used this new vector to try to cure X-ray in SCID, and the number of patients have been treated, and again we see nice reconstitution of T-cell count, perhaps a somewhat slower kinetics of this reconstitution, but in fact very effective treatment, and very importantly, so far, no leukemia. It's still early. We are still in an early phase, but the results are promising in that you already see a difference between the occurrence of leukemia in the previous trial and no leukemia happening with the current trial. I'm going to stop here in the interest of time, because we really want to take questions for you. I want to emphasize that this is just the beginning for gene therapy. And the new avenue that we want to pursue in the future is actually to correct the disease where the disease is. So do what is called gene editing. Rather than putting the gene somewhere in the DNA without knowing where it goes, we would like to correct the error in the DNA where the DNA error is. The problem with that strategy is that it's still inefficient, but again, changes in technology may make that thing possible, hopefully in the near future, and there will be a dramatic change in the way of treating this disease by gene therapy. I'll stop here.